Shabbat Shalom and welcome to Kehilat Tenuvah, The Harvest, a Messianic Charismatic congregation in Thornton, Colorado. You're listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. Our goal is to provide, for free, the message of the Torah from a Messianic Judaic perspective. Here's Pastor Mark.
Kira, is your past holding you back? That's a question for all of us. Is your past holding you back? Bad things happen to good people. Innocent people are often victimized. In fact, these kinds of things are traumatizing and often hold us back in life. Every victim of injustice or misery is faced with the question, why? Why me? Whatever it might be, abuse, circumstances, an illness, why me, right? And if we cannot reconcile this question with a meaningful answer, our existence will be plagued with anger that leads into discouragement, which leads into depression. It's a cycle that creates hopelessness in our lives. Our unreconciled past will torment us, cripple us, and destroy our future. In short, our past, if unreconciled, will hold us back from what God has for us. So, is your past holding you back? Are things that have happened in your life ever since you were a little kid pulling on you to this very day and holding you back? It's time to shift gears, to reconcile those things and free ourselves. We are in the season of Purim, and Purim is a story about a young girl who suffered great loss early in her life and was victimized in profound ways. It's a story of courage and hope, a story of overcoming overwhelming injustices. Esther. Esther is the story of God's providence over his people, over the Jewish people, his chosen ones. In the book of Esther, God is not mentioned even one time. He is never mentioned. The big question for everyone is, where is God if he's never mentioned in this book? And what is the meaning of this mystery, his absence? And what can we learn from it? You know, it's one of my favorite books, precisely because God is never mentioned. Now, I've said this before, and sometimes I'm misunderstood, but I want to talk about this a little bit. I want to explain to you why this book is one of my favorite books, precisely because God is not in it. This book reflects the beauty and wonder of what we call providence, and it's true to life. What is providence? Providence is the working of God behind the scenes in a way that is not very discernible. That is the providence of God. And this book is all about the providence of God. It's a very important theological concept that we need to actually not only grasp, but embrace. Because if we can understand God's providence, we'll make it through every dark period of our life. So many times, God seems to be missing from our lives. Isn't that true? Isn't that true to life? He seems far away. Sometimes he simply cannot be found. Even Jesus cried out in a time of overwhelming crisis, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus, the Messiah, why have you abandoned me, left me alone in my hour of need? So what will you do when you feel like God has abandoned you? And what will you do when God is apparently absent from your life and your difficulties? What will you do when bad things happen to you and you cry out to God for help, and all you hear back is your own desperate and hollow words bouncing off the walls of your own world and space that God once had occupied. Maybe you're in this place of despair and hopelessness right now. Maybe you're screaming out on the inside, God, where are you? Do you know what's happened to me? Do you even care? Why do you remain silent when I'm screaming out for help? Ever been there? Has anyone ever been there in that place? If you're in that place now, the book of Esther is for you especially. I intend to explore some of these themes in this book for a couple of weeks. There's far too much material to really go through it. It would take 10 or 12 weeks. But we'll hit some of the high points. As we ready ourselves for the annual observance of Purim, be sure to read prayerfully and carefully this book of Esther. Do it this week. Do it. If you want to enter into the fast that comes before Purim, do that as well. It's a good time to be fasting. But read the book carefully and prayerfully this week. Get ready for Purim. God will speak to you through this story. You will be strengthened and encouraged. You will connect with the Jewish people in a profound and meaningful way. As a believer, this story is your story. So get informed, get grounded in the truths found in the story of Esther. Be sure to embrace the truths, live the truths, and share the truths. That's our mission. So let's jump into the story. You ready? Let's look at the historical context. The context of this story happens at a time in which Persia is at her all-time greatest and most powerful state. Persia has become a world empire, and she has basically acquired many of the surrounding nations that are serving as vassal nations to the monarchy. She is wealthy, powerful, dominating, and many, many people groups are serving her. This is the story of Esther. This is the setting of the story of Esther. So let's look at the king, King Xerxes. The king, and I'm going to jump right into it. The king throws a 7-day gala. He is like so successful that in his third year, he decides, I'm throwing a party. In fact, he opened up the palace and the gardens and his estate in the capital city of Susa for 180 days, just displaying for everyone the wealth and beauty of the empire. And then he moves and says, I'm going to throw a 7-day party for my nobles, for the elite in the city of Susa, from all these vassal nations, right? And they can come and they can just party with me for 7 days. And in the midst of that party, the story unfolds. It begins with Vashti. And Vashti is the wife of the king. She is the queen of Persia, a very powerful, well-respected woman. Pick up the story in Esther chapter 1, 10 through 11. This is Vashti's invite from the king and refusal to come, which sets the stage for the melodrama that unfolds. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Xerxes to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. She was a babe. It's paraphrased. So we know that Vashti rejects the king, though, and doesn't come. She just defies him and says, I'm not coming. Why wouldn't Vashti come? Have you ever wondered, why would she not come? She's the queen of Persia. The king has called her. To diminish the king is to diminish her own standing in the empire. Why would Vashti not come? Glad you asked. So I'm going to get the Targum on this story of Esther. These are ancient commentaries, the first and most ancient commentaries on the Hebrew Bible, commissioned by the Sanhedrin and produced by the wisest, greatest, most popular sages of their time. And so I want to turn and read the commentary on this to give us a little background to this story. This is the Targum Sheni on Esther. Go, this is what he says. He sends his eunuchs, and he says, go, and I'm jumping in the middle of this. There's so much backdrop to this. It's an amazing story. I just don't have time. But he says to the eunuchs, go and say to Queen Vashti, arise from your royal throne and strip yourself nude, placing only the crown upon your head and a golden cup in your right hand and a golden pitcher in your left hand, and appear before me and before kings crowned with diadems, so they may see you that you are more beautiful than all the other women. Now it makes sense. They'd been drinking. Look at the text. They were merry with wine. That's code for they'd been drinking heavily. And what do men typically do? Let me rephrase that. What do pagan men who do not know the Lord typically do when they're drunk? Right? It's all about the guns, the girls, and the gold. That's usually the topics of conversation. And in this story, they're sitting around talking about who's the most beautiful women in the kingdom. Among the people groups, who do the most beautiful women come from, right? And all these nobles from these different smaller nations, they're all arguing, trying to make a case that their women are the most beautiful women. And Xerxes, the king of the empire, says, no, you're wrong. It's the Babylonian women. And I'm married to one. And I'm going to show you how beautiful she is. So he orders his eunuchs, go and get her. Tell her to strip. Tell her to just put the crown on. I want to display how beautiful she is. Typical pagan man. What does she say? She says, no. Verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. In fact, in the story, in the Targumim, what happens is Vashti says, absolutely not. I will not disgrace myself. You and you alone are the only one who has seen me without any clothes, for you're my husband. But to display my nakedness for all the men to see would be a shame and a disgrace, not for me alone, but you as well. This woman's a godly woman. This woman is an honorable woman. This woman is a woman of integrity, understanding that her sexuality, her beauty was reserved in marriage for her husband alone. Oftentimes we demonize Vashti and exalt the king. And I want to say that a closer read, especially in the commentaries, points out that the king is the one who is full of himself. And Vashti is simply a noble woman safeguarding her own integrity. So Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became angry and his wrath burned within him. The king in the Targum is so upset, and because he's drunk and angry, he basically threatens her life. Says, you don't come, I'm going to kill you. And even Vashti, in the story in the commentaries, rises up and says, do it. I'd rather die than to lower myself and shame myself in responding to your request. The king's resolution in the biblical text, take the queen's crown from her, banish her from the palace. Strip her of her authority, her honor, her place. She's out. Now, what's the problem here? He's making major decisions. Marry with wine. It's the worst time you could ever make major decisions. He wakes up the next day. He realizes what he did. It wasn't his best move. And in a short period of time, he is in a major funk. He's depressed, he's lonely, and you know what? His advisors around him are saying, you know what, we got a problem. When the king's down, you know, that's a threat to the empire. So, Esther, chapter 2, and verse 1 through 4. After these things, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. They were still drinking. Anyway, Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hege, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So that was the plan. It would unfold. It would take months to unfold. In fact, it would take more than months. It would actually take months just to prepare the women in the harem for an encounter with the king. But once they started to bring women into this place with the king, guess what happened? That, because of the amount of women in the harem, took a lot of time. So this really was good news for the king, but bad news for Esther and all the other young and innocent girls in his capital city of Susa. So enter the young teenager Hadassah, the innocent Jewish orphan who is being raised by her first cousin Mordecai. It's found in Esther chapter 2, verses 5 through 7. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jared, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem, and the captives who have been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. What does that tell us about Esther? She's an orphan. Her parents died when she was a little girl. And her cousin, her first cousin, Mordecai, adopts her. And so you think of Esther, it's a young girl who has suffered great loss. When you think about that, that's huge. That's a devastating loss to lose both your mother and your father at an early age. So in Esther chapter 2 and verse 7, it goes on to say, now the young lady, and she was probably 15, 16 years old at the time, says, now the young lady was beautiful of form and face. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Esther here is described as being beautiful. And she's beautiful in face, and she's also beautiful in form. And the Hebrew is trying to get across that Esther is a very attractive woman, easy on the eyes, beautiful in face, and also in form. She was the full package when you think of just the physical attributes of who she was. For her, that might have been a blessing. In the end, it turns to be a curse. Verse 8, it says, so it came about when the command of the decree of the king was heard that many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Hege, that Esther was taken to the king's palace in the custody of Hege, who was in charge of the women. Because she was beautiful, she was abducted. She was taken against her will. Against Mordecai's will. It was a tremendous and grievous human injustice that occurred that day when they showed up and ripped her from her cousin's care. This was truly, in some ways, a kidnapping, a forced abduction. Can you imagine what she's thinking? All she's really ever known is Mordecai. She lost her parents when she was younger. That was traumatic enough. All she has in life is this connection to her first cousin. And now even that is taken from her. Moved into a foreign place with a pagan king to live among other women abducted, to serve in his harem, to please him primarily physically. You can imagine what was going through her mind. Do you think that she was abandoned in her thinking? Do you think it crossed her mind Where is God? Why me? This brings us to the providence of God. This is the beauty and power of the story. Romans 8:31 says this, "What then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who is against us?" Number one thing, if God is for us, who can be against us? If we can catch the idea that God is for us, it resolves all other matters that we'll ever face in life, no matter how great they are or grievous or painful. It doesn't matter. If God is for us, who can be against us? It leads us to an earlier statement in 8:28. It says, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose." That God causes all things to work together for good. Yes, bad things happen to good people, but that's not the end of the script. If that's the end, then that is despairing. That is discouraging. That is overwhelming. But if God is able to cause all things that happen to us to work out together for our welfare, then we have hope in all things. Doesn't matter what it is that we have to face in life, you can fill it in with an infinite amount of bad, evil things. And this verse will see you through. God can cause it to work together for your good. What's our job? What's our job? Our job is to simply wait on God as we trust in him to perform his word. That's all we have to do. We have to wait on him. You know why? Because God has a bigger plan for our lives than we could ever, ever, ever dream of. And he's not only working out for our good, but for everyone's good. And so it's a very complicated, intricate working of God in this world to bring about his will and our welfare. So we're going to have to wait. When bad things happen, we're going to have to just suck it up and wait and trust in him and pray. And when we don't hear from him and he seems far away, to deny the scheme of the devil that says he's left you, he doesn't care for you, and to say, no, no, no. You watch his providence behind the scenes turn it all around for my benefit. What you meant for harm will come back to me in blessing. And the harm that you meant will come back to you. That's the providence of God. We see it over and over and over. Without the book of Esther, we don't have a paradigm of providence. I believe that's why it was included in the canon of Scripture. Even though many said, no, don't put it in, God's not mentioned. The wiser sages said exactly, and for that reason we'll include it. Because it gives us the hope that God is for us and not against us, even when it seems that everything says otherwise. So, it goes on to state this in Esther 2:9. "Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him." That's in reference to Hegai, the head eunuch of the harem. What's it mean that she found favor? That's a God thing. That's the providence of God, where God does a work in Hegai that automatically draws his attention to Esther and turns his heart to Esther. You say, what's the big deal? He's the one in charge of the harem. He knows the king. Through him, she can get a better positioning to become the queen. If you can see the bigger story, that's a big deal. So right away, we see the providence of God really working towards her. He gives her maidens. He gives her cosmetics. He gives her the inside track to the king. He preps her. She's just way ahead of everyone else in the harem. You say, yeah, but it's a bad deal. Well, it could have been a lot worse is the point. You can see that God's beginning to turn the tables early on. Is the glass half filled or half empty? Right? It's a matter of perspective. So let's go on, Esther 2:15. Now when the turn of Esther came, this was her chance to go in to be with the king. The daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king. She did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Do you realize that before she's even chosen by the king, all of the nobles that are around, you know, this whole event already know she's going to be queen. They know it. God has set the stage. He's turned the hearts towards Esther. It's already happening. She can't help but realize, I am becoming the queen. She had to see that as the hand of God in her life. In Esther 2:17, I'll pick up the reading. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins. Why? How did she find favor with the king? Because favor comes from God. God gave her favor. God touched the heart of the king. God was at work in the king to choose Esther. That's why that happened. That's how she was chosen. That's the providence of God on her behalf. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a banquet, a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. Esther becomes queen. The story gets better. We're going to pick this up next week. Suffice it to say that things are turning around for her. The king's learned some lessons along the way too. The king actually loves her. He actually loves Esther. He's going to actually treat her like a wife. He's going to provide for her. He's going to honor her. He's going to cover her. He too has turned some corners. And what looked like a desperate situation for the first time, looks like maybe God is involved in this for Esther. She had a lot to complain about. She had a lot to hold her back in terms of what had happened to her in her life. So how did she get past all of this? How did she get free from her past? I believe it. It's because she understood the providence of God. And once she discovered the providence of God, she was able to reconcile her past. No longer would her past define her or control her. The providence of God would set her free. She would realize it doesn't matter what happened. God can cause it to work towards my benefit. He can turn the tables. I think that's how we can be thankful in all that has happened to us. It's in the construct of his providence that we can be thankful. So the solution, if your past is holding you back, the solution is to humble yourself, cry out to God. Know that God is for you and not against you. And that if God is for you, who can be against you? Refuse to live by your feelings. Refuse to live under your circumstances. Rather, live by faith. Yes, you'll have to wait. I don't know how long you'll have to wait before that changes. The good news is it will change. God is at work. He will bring that all to pass. So hold your head up. Grab hold of the providence of God. Know that he's for you and not against you. Trust in the providence of God. Why? Because we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. He's there, even though you can't always discern it. When he seems far away, he's not. He's all around you, working behind the scenes. Just because you don't sense it, don't make the mistake of thinking it's not true. It is true. Learn to trust and wait on him. He will never, ever disappoint you. Shabbat shalom.
Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, speak to Aaron and his sons saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And we add, in the name of Yeshua, our Messiah, the Prince of Peace, so you shall put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Yivarech Adonai ve'yishmerecha. Yaher Adonai panav alecha ve'yihunecha. Yisa Adonai panav alecha ve'asem lecha shalom. Shabbat shalom.
You've been listening to the Shabbat message delivered by Senior Pastor Mark McClellan. We hope you have found this teaching relevant and challenging for your life. If you are in the Metro Denver area, please join us on Shabbat. Service starts at 1 p.m. and ends at 3 p.m. Kehillah Tenuva is located at 8891 Pose Boulevard in Thornton, Colorado, just a few miles north of downtown Denver. For more information, please visit www.graftedin.com. That's www.graftedin.com. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 29993, Thornton, Colorado, 80229. For inquiries, please call 303-761-9948 or email info@graftedin.com. Thank you for listening to the Shabbat message. Shabbat Shalom and Shavua Tov. Shabbat.